Extra time.
Hello and welcome back to the Extra Time podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten. And this week I've got two very special guests. I've got Michael McCubbin. How are you, Michael?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, mate. Not too bad.
Yeah, you said that you went running in the cold at the weekend, which sounded ill-advised.
Yeah, not great. It was my final chance, though. We had that storm. I can't remember what the name of the storm is this time, but there was that storm coming in with all the snow. So I thought, out on Saturday, and then, yeah, I basically can't run for another 3 or 4 days. Or at least I can give myself that excuse.
yeah, same.
So yeah, I've just been indoors like a dormouse ever since.
Yeah, we're back in hibernation now. Whereas coming out of hibernation is Sam Abasaki. What's up, Sam? How are you doing?
I'm good, bro. I'm happy to be back. Yeah, like you said, I'm coming back from hibernation. Kind of like the dead, because I felt like I was just not doing anything, to be honest. But yeah, no, I'm happy to be back, man.
I've got to say, your hair situation is making me and McCubbin look extremely unkempt right now. Your shit is lined up, whereas like I've realised that I've got at least another month of looking like this, and it's killing me.
Honestly, if you saw me after that little hibernation, you would have been questioned. I don't even think you would have known it was me. That's how bad it was. So I needed to get this done in here.
Well, you're looking sharp today. You're looking like Steve Jobs, man.
You actually are.
So shall we go straight into the content from the weekend? Because today we're going to do a bit of a roundup of the action. And I was planning on doing that, but I was absolutely relieved watching Man City Liverpool yesterday. Because at one stage I was like, oh God, this is going to be 0-0. But in the end, City go 5 points clear at the top of the league with a game in hand after battering Liverpool 4-1 at Anfield. Now, that puts City 10 points ahead of champions. And after a run of 68 games unbeaten at home, Liverpool have now lost 3 consecutively. Sam, how was it to watch this game? Were you impressed by City, and who in particular impressed you?
I loved it. I'm not going to lie to you. I tweeted as well. I said, I would love to say that I hate seeing Liverpool go out like this, but I'd be lying, because a lot of the chat that was happening last year about them being one of the best teams to ever win the Premier League, one of the best teams to ever grace the Premier League, obviously that happens, but there was this cockiness that their fans had that I just didn't really appreciate. And obviously that little altercation that he had with Lampard when Lamps was just like, you've only won one and you're giving it the bigger, you know what I mean? Like I felt like that as well, innit? So yeah, the game, throughout that game I was like, yeah, it's nice to see Liverpool like this. But to be honest, it wasn't anyone that you'd expect to run the show. It was Phil Foden. That guy was running the show. Like, there was all that speculation about whether he should have left City to get more minutes because of players like Sancho, players like other players at his age that are getting more minutes. But the trust that Pep has shown him and given him, yeah, is paying off. Like, he is looking like such a seasoned player in so many different positions as well. He played the false nine yesterday, and he looked like he's played there for the last season. He was all over the place, and his goal was amazing. Like, yeah, he just looks so comfortable. He gives everyone a problem that he plays against. And I've not really seen him drop a performance below a 7. So, yeah, I think he was the star man for me, to be honest.
Interesting. I think that brings us on to one of our first talking points, right? Because, yeah, as Sam says, Phil Foden, incredible goal that he scored. Also, that amazing run to set up Gundogan for the goal that put City ahead again after Liverpool pulled it back through a penalty. 2 goals for Gundogan in the game, bringing him to 9 for the season. But all the talk afterwards has been about Phil Foden. McCubs, do you think that this performance, and more broadly his performances this season, mean that Foden now has to be a nailed-on starter for club and maybe for country?
It's a tough one with country, isn't it? Because obviously we're so stacked, or England are so stacked in that position. I think he should be starting for City every week, to be honest. I've been putting him in and out of my fantasy team this season with the hope that he would be starting every game. And I've been kind of disappointed a little bit that he hasn't. I think obviously this season is like no other. There's a lot of rotation going on, but I think, you know, Foden is young, super fit, hasn't had any major injury, any major injuries so far in his career, has he? I feel like he is in quite good shape to be starting games every 3 or 4 days at this moment in time anyway. But I guess, you know, I guess Pep likes to switch things up, doesn't he, depending on which team he's playing against. But yeah, I mean, compared to, say, last year, I seem to remember there was quite an infamous episode of Continental Club where we were discussing Phil Foden. I think you said something along the lines, Pat, of him being nothing more than an eyebrow slip.
I remember that as well, actually.
And that was quite a provocative way of basically saying that Pep should be, if he was good enough, then Pep would be playing him a lot more. And it was true. Pep wasn't playing. I don't think Pep was putting enough trust in him even a year ago when already we were seeing signs of what he's capable of. Mm. So yeah, it's really good. It's just great to see him. As for the England thing, yeah, it's a tough one. I think he's definitely got to be on the plane for the Euros.
100%.
But whether he suits that England setup, like, it's just hard to, because I feel like Mount is probably a surefire starter at the moment, isn't he? Gareth Southgate loves Mason Mount, so that leaves only one position at most really for Grealish, Foden, and I guess Madison to fight over. I think Grealish and Foden are probably the outstanding candidates there. Mm. So it's a tough one. I think ultimately, like, whether or not Foden is starting for England every game, that doesn't take away from how good he is. I think it's just more of a sign of just how stacked England are in that position. But yeah, if he kind of can exert this kind of influence like he did in the Liverpool game in multiple other games towards the end of the season, then yeah, I think Southgate's going to have a proper headache in terms of who he positions or how he sets that team up, even, because at the moment it's looking like there's too much attacking talent there for England to even set up with more than one defensive midfielder. So yeah, it's looking like it's going to have to be all out attack for the three lines if they want to get the most out of the talent they've got.
Yeah, well, in contrast to the last World Cup, of course, when they were criticised for being too defensive. Yeah. You're right, like, the squad is so top-heavy. Though also, I've got to say, you know, like, you can kind of see the preference for Mount and Foden sometimes to Grealish, because though Grealish is such an incredible talent, he doesn't have the defensive intensity that Mount and Foden do have. I mean, Foden in this game made three tackles and interceptions, which isn't like a crazy number, but it's more than anyone on the City side except for Rodri, Cancelo and Zinchenko. Working so hard. And, you know, I think he completed two dribbles, but I think both of those were in the box as well. So, I mean, he does just seem to kind of come alive in the final third. And I also thought we should maybe talk about Raheem Sterling.
Yeah.
Because I thought Raheem Sterling had an absolutely fantastic game. I mean, that penalty he won was the 21st penalty he's won in the Premier League. That's more than any other player in the history of the competition. Sam, Sterling has often been criticised, specifically in games against Liverpool, right?
Yeah.
But how influential do you think he was in this match?
I think it's something that we've kind of overlooked with Sterling. I think he's been a star man for City, like, maybe from the second season or the third season that he came in. And because we're so used to him being so good, sometimes when we see things like that and see stats like that, it's like, wow. But realistically, when you watch him play, you realise he causes every back line problems. Like, he's so influential, and it's even more, you can see it more now with Pep giving him the armband. Like, there's senior players in the squad, but Sterling is rightfully so getting that armband because of not just the influence he has on the pitch, but obviously with the younger players as well now. So I think Sterling has been one of those players that is gone, not under the radar because we know how good he is, but because he's been so good for so long, it's like, okay, yeah, that's just Sterling doing his thing. Like, he was caught, Trent was spinning. Like, the majority of that game, he was spinning. And I felt like, if I felt sorry for any player in that team, it was Trent, because it's like they kind of saw that Sterling had him, and he's like, yeah, go at him every time, go at him every time. And obviously, he's not the one that gave away the pen, but he got past him to win the pen. Do you get what I'm saying?
So, yeah.
Yeah, man. Sterling's quality, man.
I feel like we almost rate Sterling, or I feel like Sterling has to meet like such a big level now for high people to actually note on him. Like, I think it was 2018-19 when he had that really world class season when he was easily one of the top three or four like wide forwards in world football. And then I feel like last term, like, maybe I think De Bruyne's performances maybe overshadowed him a bit, but he still ended the season with like a really, really top goal output. I think he did nearly reach 20 goals or reach the 20 goal mark. I can't quite remember. This season it's only really been in the last kind of 5 weeks that I think his performances have definitely got a lot better in the last 5 weeks. But yeah, I think we're kind of appreciating him again. And I think also that maybe has something to do with the fact that De Bruyne is not in this team anymore. So like Sterling has that bit more responsibility to actually like drive that attack. And I feel like maybe that's why in 18-19 he was so highly praised and why he was just so good week in, week out, because he had that responsibility. Like without KDB in that team, like you need a ball carrier who can just make things happen like all the time. And like Sterling just was that guy, wasn't he, on Sunday?
Did you see this incredible stat that I think normally stats that appear on the screen during matches are rubbish? Like, but this one, it said Sterling is only the third player to score 100 or more goals under Guardiola. The other two are Messi and Aguero.
That's mad.
Isn't that insane?
That's incredible. Crazy.
And I think he's on 8 goals and I think maybe 4 assists in the league this season. The only person for City with more goals is Gundogan, who's now got 9 in his best ever goal scoring campaign. Really incredible from him. But I think, look, I'm glad that we've praised City, but I do think, and maybe this is just me because I'm an Arsenal fan coming off the week of that David Luiz red card against Wolves, but I do think Liverpool can maybe be a bit aggrieved about the penalty incident, because Ruben Dias, Salah got past him, a little bit of luck because Dias got to the ball and it rebounded. It was a bit unlucky. But then he pulled Salah back. Salah is fouled, but does one of the worst dives I've ever seen. Like, yeah. I mean, genuinely, like he's like platoon, like his arms go up in the air and it's like, but if that's given as a penalty, McCubbin, we've already had a slight disagreement on this. Like, surely that has to be a red card. There's no attempt to play the ball. Like, if it's a penalty, it has to be a red, doesn't it?
Not in my mind, mainly because Stones is coming in there. And I know we were chatting before about, you know, last man / clear goal scoring opportunity. Technically, I guess that is a clear goal scoring opportunity. But then if Stones is going to get there and make that challenge, which I think he probably is going to do, does that, like, I feel like that kind of negates the goal scoring opportunity. But I think in a week where we saw that David Luiz red card, where we saw the Ben red card, although that was overturned, there's obviously more pressure for VAR to then kind of back that up with another call, which falls within the rules there. But personally, I think it would have been a harsh and probably the wrong decision as well. Although I don't know, it's a difficult one with these ones. It's like, you could play it completely by the book, or you could make what is a fair judgment. And I think the fair judgment is to not send him off for that.
I mean,
yeah, it's a tough one, because like, I know like the Luiz red card wasn't overturned. And that was like, obviously like completely accidental as well. But I think just because one call was made wrong, and even if they're sticking by it, doesn't mean that you have to then make another wrong call.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I guess my issue is that like, when an attacker gets past you in the box and you pull him back, you are doing something which you know is like foul play. You're trying unfairly to gain an advantage, and you know if it gets called, you're probably going to get red carded now. Like, I mean, I think that Stones is getting across, but I also wouldn't be surprised if Salah gets the shot off before he's there. And then I'm kind of like, is being in the box with a defender trying to close you down, like, is that a clear goal scoring opportunity? I'd say that, yeah, it probably is. I mean, Sam, I think we need you to break the deadlock on this one. Like, how do you feel about it?
The thing is, yeah, it's hard because, like Mikey said, it's so inconsistent. And my biggest problem, yeah, with these calls isn't the fact that we have VAR. It's the fact that the people that are using it are the people that are the ones that are constantly making mistakes. Like, it's like VAR, I genuinely don't think VAR is the problem. Like, I don't think having an assistant referee that can oversee the game is the problem. It's the fact that the referees that normally make the bad decisions when they're on the pitch can't seem to make the right decisions when they're in the booth as well. So it's just like all of these problems are still going to continue because, like you said, the inconsistency with the David Luiz thing. And I think that call was off of the fact of David Luiz's reputation, if we're being honest, because he's had certain mm-hmm. situations mm-hmm. like that where the players run across him and he's done this and then they've fallen over, and obviously it can give you that 50-50, and normally he does get set off for it. So that referee just thought, okay, let me just continue the tradition, yeah. But with the Salah thing, it's like, if you're gonna make a bad call if you're gonna make a call with David Luiz, with Bednarek against United, and you're gonna see all of these, you're the defender before the player gets a shot off in the box, and two have been given a red card. You just have to, like, we will complain, but at least we'll complain at the fact that all of them are soft in it. If there's one referee that's saying, oh, no, I think this is a yellow, and then there's two saying, no, I think this is a red, you're just giving people too much to talk about. And mm-hmm. that, like, are they not tired of people just constantly yeah. talking about why VAR is bad and what needs to change? It's getting boring now.
I do think, though, that VAR wasn't necessarily brought in to stop debate and stop, like, personal interpretation of a rule, though, right? Like, I feel
supposed
like
to that be was, consistent, that, though, isn't it?
That, yeah, for sure. It should be as consistent as they can make it. But, like, I do also think, like, before VAR got brought in, people were quite annoyed at the idea that everything was going to be straight down the line and that wasn't going to be debate over anything. And I feel like what really is there is just as a tool, right? Rather than something whereby every decision is exactly the same, because otherwise there's not really a point in having a referee on the pitch if they can't kind of bring their kind of own personal judgment into it.
But that thing, like, there's so much, it does really come down to that decision on the pitch, doesn't it? Because, like, because of this phrasing of, like, VAR is there to correct clear and obvious errors, it does mean this idea that, like, if the referee makes a call, which is a judgment call, which actually I think we've learned over the last kind of year and a half, most calls are judgment calls. That's something we've discovered now. Like, you're just not going to overturn it. And so, yeah, like, it does basically seem to say, like, we have these rules, but they will never be applied consistently because we're never going to hang a referee out to dry. But, I mean, to me, it also does show a general lack of faith in, like, football fans in referees, because I think everybody kind of assumes that referees are going to cover each other's arses rather than necessarily try and get the right decision. And that is a bit of an issue, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, with the rise of kind of people like Peter Walton on TV and, like, the kind of the referee's perspective and stuff, it's very, very rare to see a referee actually disagree with a ref. But, I mean, I don't know, it goes both ways, doesn't it? You know, Mike Dean's now, you know, after that Suchek red card, was receiving death threats and has asked to not referee in the Premier League this week. So I think as much as we do, like, moan about refs and about kind of refs kind of sticking together and not really criticising each other as much as perhaps they should, or at least as much as we'd like them to. There's that other flip side whereby it's like, yeah, I mean, they do deserve some protection in some ways.
I was just going to say, I think it does get a bit harsh, like, on referees, but I think it's more the fact that over the years where we see so many decisions, and I'm not saying that people making death threats and stuff like that is okay, because that's just taking it too far. But, like, with referees, I feel like they're protected so much in terms of, like, the decisions that they made. Like, if they kind of gave even if, like, this is a stretch here, but if they said referees have to come out the same way that managers have to come out after games and give press conference because of certain decisions and that, if they came and asked you certain questions and said, yeah, like, how do you feel about this decision? Looking back at it, would you, like, just more honesty rather than you're just seeing them make a bad decision and then the next game they come, another bad decision, next game, and then if anyone speaks out against it, they're fined 20,000. Then they're fined, like, I think if the referees were given a bit more, like, they had to be more accountable for the decisions that they made, yeah, I think a lot of more fans would, obviously they would still be frustrated about some of the decisions, but at least hearing them say why or what their thought process was would be a bit better, in my opinion. Anyway, I would want that.
I kind of get that. Like, I do sort of agree that sometimes, like, referees are just not asked to justify themselves. And I feel like in any other job, if you had like a genuinely disastrous day that was like, that showed that you did a bad job, you would kind of be asked to justify yourself. But I don't know. I mean, like, to me, again, this is like, if we want to protect referees, the way to do it is to make sure the rules are set up to protect referees. And like, after these games, I think, I don't know. I find it weird that everyone will go after like Mike Dean, because to me, like, I just assume referees are going to make bad decisions. And what frustrates me is that I'm like, why do we have VAR here if not to correct these bad decisions? But what's annoying is then when VAR doesn't overturn a decision, and then after the match, you know, like, referees say, oh, we've had to apologise to Man United for the bad decisions we made in their game. It's like, you had the capacity to sort this out at the time and you didn't.
Literally.
And then afterwards it's like, oh, sorry about that. It's like, no, it's, I don't want your apology. I want you not to do it in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, it's so irritating. I mean, like, I don't know. Like, it just feels to me like the way that VAR is being run and the way that some of the rules are at the moment, that is making life worse for referees rather than protecting them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Because everyone's... Yeah, it adds that... Well, the VAR adds the extra level of frustration, doesn't it? And then and then when it's the wrong call, it's the referee who ultimately gets the flak, isn't it? I think well, like with those handball rules at the start of the season, or the handball rule that was then changed, like, I think it's with something like this, I think they may well have to take a look at it. And in that sense, maybe if the Cancelo challenge was given a red, then maybe there'd be more scope for it, because then you'd have another set of fans who are getting annoyed about it, and there'd be more pressure on the authorities. But it does seem a bit weird how that Luis red card, I don't know, it does seem a little bit freak how, when the rules state that if it's accidental, it shouldn't be a red card, right? And it was clearly accidental, and yet it was given. I don't know. I feel like it's the sort of thing that could blow over in the next couple of weeks, or there could be another couple of decisions. And then we'll be talking about it for another month, and maybe they'll be forced to come up with some sort of explanation or some sort of rule change. But
yeah,
right now it seems, I don't know, hoping that will just be a freak incident.
Well, on the topic of bad decisions, before we move out of this section, should we do a little bit of chat about Liverpool?
Yeah.
After the game, obviously they were, basically the talk was that like their title race was over. I think that's partially because of how good City are right now, rather than because Liverpool are particularly terrible. But, you know, Klopp was talking about, you know, solidifying the place in the top four. Sam, how concerned do you think we should be given Liverpool's run of form? Because since the end of December, they've taken 7 points from seven games, which ranks 13th in the Premier League, and they've scored seven and conceded nine in that time. Now, expected goals says they should be a little bit better off. I think it says they should have scored 11, conceded nine. They should have closer to 12 points. But even that would still be fifth or sixth best in the league. Do you think that the signings they've made in January are going to correct this issue? Or do you think that there are deeper problems at Liverpool right now?
I think there's been deeper problems at Liverpool ever since we always had the conversation of, if someone got injured, they will be in big trouble. And then they literally had injury upon injury upon injury. And then it was like, okay, now they're in big trouble. And I think it didn't help that Klopp started the season in that mood of just being moany about everything. Like, I've never seen him so affected by, like, obviously a lot of the decisions, I can understand it, because obviously a lot of these players were getting injured off of playing too many games, fatigue and stuff like that. But it was something that everyone had to go through. So once you address it once, which managers like Ole and Lampard did at the time, then it is what it is. The managers vote and then you keep it moving. But he was just, there was always something to complain about. Like, when I've never seen him so rattled. And I think that type of energy, if you're going into that energy in the press conference, I'm only imagining him going into the training ground saying, oh, like, I know we're on the back foot, like, type of thing, or that type, you know what I mean? Like, it will kind of rub off on the players. And they've not really, like, their defence up until like the 4-1 hasn't been terrible. Like, do you get what I'm saying? Like,
no,
they've
still fine,
had
yeah.
they've had Mane, Firmino, Salah still available. They brought in Thiago, still had Ronaldo available as well. I just think that it's just it's a strange one because if you look at their team, they shouldn't be struggling like this. But at the same time, obviously, a big factor that I saw online recently is that the energy that Liverpool get from their fans is something different to anyone else, any other team in the world, basically. So that's one factor that is probably affecting them as well. And all of the things that are going on around the season, like COVID, you're thinking a player is going to play a few games, like Matip came in a few games and he gets injured. Like, it's just hitting them. Like, it's one after the other. When Mane had a few good games, got hit with injury. Shaqiri came in, yeah, he's good, but he's not really good enough. Their bench isn't strong enough to compete. So even him asking for five subs, it's not like they're going to bring on any, like, world beaters. So I think they need to... They should have brought in more players when they were at that peak, like, and thought about players that they maybe should have replaced. Like Ronaldo, he hasn't signed a new contract yet. Yeah, he was a starter, and yeah, he's good, and he served his time at Liverpool. But at the same time, if a player doesn't want to be there, you brought in Thiago, you get him out, you bring in someone that is hungry to compete again for Liverpool. Like, that would be a big difference. Do you get what I'm saying? But I think obviously with the funds as well, the COVID has affected the funds as well. So I think a lot of things have gone wrong with Liverpool. But I think one of the main things for me is Klopp's attitude coming into the season and how the injuries and that has affected him.
Mm-hmm. I get that. I do kind of see where you're coming from, because at stages it was like, I'm never sure how much weight to give this stuff, because, you know, like, I'm not a professional footballer, so I don't know how much this stuff affects players in the dressing room. But, like, yeah, the idea of, like, he was talking like they were underdogs from the beginning, which was a really strange position to be in, or as if, like, they were facing issues that other teams weren't. I wanted to ask you about that, McCubbin, because, like, obviously Pep Guardiola made a big thing about, like, look, we're pressing less, we're running less, and you're never quite sure how seriously to take Pep when he says things like that. But do you think that given the fixture congestion and given the injuries, maybe Klopp would have been better off reining things in and playing a little bit less of their high energy, high pressing style just to kind of give these guys a bit of a rest? Because now this team, you know, we've talked about this season after season, like Sam saying, we were like, if Robertson gets injured, Robertson's playing 50 games a season for 3 years in a row. These things become inevitable at some stage.
Oh yeah, massively. And I mean, it's been a general trend, hasn't it, this season that teams are pressing less. And even I think that you can, that's the same for Liverpool as well. But yeah, in this game, I think it's a tough one, because I think Liverpool have always had particular success with pressing Man City. That was always one of their slight weaknesses, even in their best days under Pep Guardiola. I mean, you could argue right now is one of their best days, but, you know, in 17, 18... 18-19, even then they would come a little bit unstuck if you press them high. Remember Pochettino's Tottenham doing it to them. It's a particularly good effect on a couple of occasions as well. I guess Klopp maybe just kind of went with what he knew kind of worked in the past against City, and this current City side are just a lot sharper. They've just got a lot more quality in the midfield and all over the pitch, really, haven't they? And are obviously a lot more impenetrable at the back than they were, say, last year. So I think maybe that high pressing style wasn't maybe implemented in the best way against City. Equally, if Liverpool had sat back, I think they would have come in for a lot of criticism at Anfield in such a big game, to then just try and hit City on the break, which is not worked for any team in the last 2 months. So I think it's a difficult one. I think Liverpool were going into it on the back foot. I think Klopp has been particularly, kind of annoyed this season. Seems to have had a lot more of a chip on his shoulder, chatting back at, you know, pundits and whatnot in the studio, which I've actually quite enjoyed, to be honest. I find it quite entertaining.
He's on to Jeff Reeves as well.
Sorry?
He's on to Jeff Reeves as well.
Massively.
Any question he asks him.
Oh my God. That interview, was it after the Brighton game? God, that was weird. But what's it called? I think it's firstly, I think, a sign of a manager who no longer has anything to prove in the Premier League, which is right. Like, Jurgen Klopp doesn't really have anything left to prove. But also, yeah, it's definitely a sign of a manager who's really up against it this season. The injury, you can't look past those injuries. And I think the the main thing, which has been discussed a lot before, is what those injuries have meant for both the defence and midfield, isn't it? Because I think if you don't have one of Fabinho or Henderson in that midfield, it just doesn't operate in the same way that it did before. And I think Thiago's come in for unnecessary flack, but even just the fact, and Thiago's a world class, you know, central midfielder. There's no doubt about that. But not having one of them in there, I think there's just like a slight lack of familiarity in a season where already players are having to adapt to a new schedule. I think, not having especially Henderson in that midfield. I think there's just a bit of a lack of familiarity in terms of like the last two seasons. That first 11 has basically been exactly the same, hasn't it? And not having a figure like Henderson in the midfield, I think that, you know, negates from the defence. I think that negates from Robertson and Trent's kind of function on out wide. And then ultimately, actually, against City, the defence was, you know, at fault for a few of the goals. I know Alisson was mainly culpable, but I think there were, you know, a couple of occasions, I think especially for Gundogan's second, where I think Van Dijk gets across there. I think even Matip gets across there to clear the danger when Alisson parries it. So I think there's a number of factors, but yeah, those injuries have completely messed up Liverpool's season.
Well, just before we get out of this section, just a final prediction from both of you. Where do you think Liverpool will finish the season? Because I'm going to say still second. I still find it hard to see a team beating them second.
Yeah, I think I'd go for second as well, to be honest.
I'll say second or third. Second or third.
If they finish third, who will finish second, Sam? No, don't. Come on.
Come on. I was going to say Chelsea, to be honest, but yeah, United. We're 1 point behind Liverpool, you know, don't get it twisted.
Yeah, it's true. Oh, Tuchel's magic.
I haven't missed magic.
He's forgotten all about Lampard, hasn't he?
I've just
completely forgotten about him.
If you get smug about Chelsea, then I'm gonna leak the FD WhatsApp. I'm gonna put some screenshots up of you and Zach absolutely losing your minds in the group chat when Frank was on his way out, which was very funny. But moving on from what is kind of a feel bad story for fans on Merseyside, I've got two choices for you. I want you guys to pick where we go for our other story of the day. So we can either talk about the title race in Italy and AC Milan, or we can talk about the title race in France and Lille. What are you saying, guys? What's your preference?
I like what AC are on, to be honest. And I've been watching them more, to be honest.
All right, cool. Let's talk about that then, because Milan are back on top of Serie A with a 4-0 win over Crotone on Sunday. That puts them 2 points ahead of Inter and 7 up on Juve, who do have a game in hand. And it was a very special day for Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He scored twice, as did Ante Rebic, but Zlatan's brace brought up his 500th career goal. Believe it or not, his first career goal came over 21 years ago.
Mad.
Sam, where does this rank? Where do you think that Zlatan ranks now over the last 10 years? Because he kind of, you know, he was in France and we were like, well, he's in France, you know, whatever, anyone can score in France. Then he came to the Prem with United and I thought was fantastic. Then he went to MLS and we were like, oh, okay, Zlatan's over again, we can forget about him. And now he's back in Italy and he's absolutely tearing it up. Only Cristiano Ronaldo scored more league goals than him in Italy this season. He's 40 this year.
He's actually doing a madness in it. That's the only way you can describe it, because I literally remember when they were getting rid of Piatek and bringing in Ibra. Obviously Piatek wasn't banging at the time, but they were saying like, how are you going to get a 38 year old to come and replace like calmly aged striker, do you get what I'm saying? And I've never even said that before, but no, like, he's actually proved everyone wrong, and I can kind of see that he's brought that like winning mentality to the side as well. AC just look like a different side this year, man. They just seem hungrier, and he's obviously leading the charge, even in the derby where he got into it with Lukaku. That was one of the best Milan derbies that I've watched in a while. Do you get what I'm saying? Just because it was so feisty, like, you could see what it meant, and that came from him just saying like obviously he said a few madnesses, but it was just like Like, you know, you know what I mean? But you know who I am. Like, you know what we are. Do you know what this team is, type of thing? And I think that type of energy is an energy that he's given to the AC Milan side. Like, no one would have expected them to be doing this well for this long as well. Obviously, a good period at the beginning of the season. But for them to be consistent, they've only lost one, or they've only lost one, right?
I think they might have lost. Is it one or two? It's not many.
Yeah, like for them to be at this point, and for him to Ronaldo only has more goals than him as well. Like, that's mad. Like, for them both to be at the top of the chart is mad anyway. But for Ibra to be there at the age of 39 is crazy, innit? There's nothing. Yeah. He's literally proven all that third person chat is working for him.
Is that it? That's his superpower, the third person. Well, I mean, I've just checked and they've lost twice this season. But I mean, still pretty amazing. McCubbin, at what point do we say that Milan are favourites? I mean, like, a lot of us all along have kind of been like, Inter seem a bit deeper. Like, we like Conte a little bit more, or Juve have a better squad, or whatever it might be. But at what point do we say Milan not only can do this, but like are odds on to do this?
Yeah, it's a tough one because, like, I mean, my argument with Inter, like you were saying, is generally been that they've got a slight deeper squad, more accomplished manager as well, perhaps a few more match winners as well. At least that midfield just is just a lot more stacked. But having said that, AC Milan is still top of the league, and they've had Bennacer out for however many games. I think he's just come back, has he? But like, and that's with that kind of midfield of Kessier and Tonali, and I think Tonali's had a pretty decent season, but I don't think he's he's definitely not the finished product, is he? Milan have dealt with kind of multiple injury problems throughout the campaign, not least as Zlatan himself. I think Pioli has done like a pretty amazing job of adapting that team when Zlatan's been out of the side. So,
yeah.
I mean, so far they've passed every test, really. It's just that little thing. I think if they were like 5 points clear at this point, then you'd kind of be like, okay, like this is very serious. Like, they are favourites now. But just because that title race is particularly tight now, I think Milan 1 or 2 points behind, Inter, 1 or 2 points behind, and then
two behind,
and then if Juve win their game in hand, I'm not sure when that game in hand will be played, because I think it's them and Napoli who have a game in hand, and yet they're playing this coming weekend when everyone else is playing, so I'm not quite sure when that's going to even up. But if Juve win that game in hand, they're 4 points behind. So I can't really call it at all for them at the moment. I think I think it's literally just a points difference. If they can build up a decent points difference in the next month, then they will be odds on. But I think it's just, still question marks over, I don't know. It's just, they've been great, but Inter are lying in wait, aren't they? That's the thing. I just always back Inter in that sense.
No, everyone's just always expecting Juve to come back into it, like, by one
that
point,
well.
By end of the season, that you know well. What I mean? But
but I just think, I think that, like, the difference this year is just, like, that lack of experience for Pirlo. Like, that's the thing. Like, Pirlo might turn out to be a great manager, but he might turn out to be, a Frank Lampard manager.
Don't do that. Like a
C-plus manager. Like, not bad, but not good. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just hard to tell. And I think, like, that is the X factor this season. So I'm going to make you guys make a prediction. Sam, I mean, do you just go with Juve then? Or do you find a middle ground here and maybe pick Inter or something?
You know what? I was actually... I think that Inter have to win it this year, to be honest. Ooh. Because Conte's been there for what, 2 years now? This is his second year, right?
Yeah.
So he's come in to win that title, to bring it back to Milan, and now AC are doing it instead, and also they're out of the Champions League as well, so they kind of need this, like, more than AC and Juve, to be honest. So I'm counting on Lukaku to lead the charge and bridge the gap.
Interesting. Inter Milan. I mean, also Napoli and Roma, like, you could argue it's potentially a closing window, because, like, you have got teams like Napoli and Roma who've been very impressive this season. And, you know, Roma will probably get a new striker in the summer. Juve, if they don't win the title, you'd expect to go out and spend big to rejig things. McCubs, what do you think? Who's going to end up on top of the pile at the end of the season?
Yeah, I think I agree with Sam in that, I think Inter probably are under the most pressure. Like you said, Conte's second season. And he's had a lot of investment since coming in, hasn't he? I feel like he's pretty much got most of the players that he's asked for. Obviously, that Hakimi signing was pretty big in the summer. Barella got made permanent. I think I am still just about backing Inter. But bit if AC do pull away more in the next month, then I think I'll probably switch my prediction. But yeah, at this moment in time, I'm still backing Inter.
I'm going to go for Inter as well. I think Inter as well. But again, it's just because they've got that points advantage on Juve, and I think their squad is like deeper than Milan, and I just trust Conte, man. I just think Conte's going to pull something out of the bag when it matters. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the show for today. Before we say goodbye, is there anything that you guys would like us to promote? Anything that either of you guys have written or been on? I know that Sam, you're doing some Snapchat right now.
Yeah, if you guys are on Snapchat, go check that out, the Football Daily Snapchat. We've also got a Transfer Talk Snapchat that we've just recently launched as well. So if you're on Snap, or if you're not on Snap, download it. Even if it's just for us, we'd really appreciate it. You know what I mean? You see my face on it a few days as well. So yeah, if you're on that, check it out.
What about you, Sweet. Mikey? What would you like to promote?
I'm not sure if I've written anything of note really recently, not in the last week at least. But but the Football Pyramid Final on Euro Football Daily was between me and Hamill. So go and check that out. That was a good battle. Go and check that. And then there's been a couple of really interesting EFD explains come out recently on Euro Football Daily as well. So one on Bayer Leverkusen, which I believe you wrote, Pat, right? And one on La Liga, which was a couple of weeks ago. And there's another one which has escaped me. But go and check those out. Go and show those some love.
Nice. Thanks very much. And thanks to you guys for watching or listening at home. Please make sure that you subscribe to our channel on YouTube, Football Daily Podcast, or subscribe to us as a podcast, an audio podcast, using whichever app you prefer. We really do appreciate it, and we appreciate 5-star reviews as well. So thank you very much for watching/listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye.
Peace.